Well, it's a pleasure to be here, and I'd like to thank the organizers for the invitation to come and tell you a little bit about some work that that I've been involved in recent years. We've been working on topological insulators, and it's really a fantastic field. I was working for a few years before this in the world of strongly correlated electrons, where there's lots of interesting things to do. But we kind of, you know, all the low-hanging fruit have been plucked. And with this field, we just, you know, every day we think up something new to do, a new experiment, and it's really been a tremendous amount of fun. Before I get into it, let me acknowledge the people who have done the majority of the work. Where's a laser pointer? Is this it here, this green thing? So yeah, hopefully I don't have to ask theorists for help. OK, yes. So I'd like to acknowledge this. It's not cast of thousands, but teams of people who have been involved in various aspects of the work. So I will thank a few people foremost. So my postdoc, Rolando Valdez Aguilar, has led this effort for the last year, looking at TI thin films. And now it's being picked up by a new postdoc, Andreas Steyer, and a student, Liang Wu, who have just both started with me. People who do spectroscopy know, it may not be common knowledge to the theorist community, but it probably is, that all real progress in this field and fields like this really depend on materials. And so the real true advances are made in that regard. And I've been very, very fortunate to work with a fantastic sample grower and an experimentalist, Sean Oh from Rutgers, and it's been really a fantastic, very fruitful collaboration working together. He's growing the high quality thin films, which I'm going to tell you about. We're also collaborating with my colleague Tyrell McQueen at Johns Hopkins University and his student. We're starting to work on various examples of 3D materials, which may show this vial fermion state, and Tyrell has been growing these films of that. And I also want to point out Chris Morris, who was until 2 weeks ago a student of Mark Sherwin here at UCSB and is now a postdoc with me. Also, I should point out Andrea Markowitz and John Cherney at the University of Buffalo, who we did a lot of the magnetoresistance measurements in the beginning. Magnetoconductive measurements, excuse me. Okay, so first I give you my conclusions to start it off, tell you where I'm going. I think what we have shown as a result of this kind of exhaustive effort looking at different layer thickness materials, that we have evidence for essentially thickness independence, surface state transport in the topological insulator bismuth selenide. I'll tell you a little bit, if you will, about an aspect which may have more to do with chemistry than physics. And this is an aspect of something we found quite unexpected about sample aging. These materials, thin films, they change with time. And that's actually, it turns out to be a good thing for looking at the surface transport properties. I will tell you the main gist of the talk, we'll talk about colossal Kerr rotation, the Kerr rotation measurements that we're doing. And if I get to it, and people are interested, tell you a little bit about the work on bilayer superconductor TI interfaces. OK, so first, I only know a few of you here. So just to give you a brief introduction, my group at Johns Hopkins works on low-frequency electromagnetic probes of solids. So these are specific, kind of specialized techniques, specifically looking down at frequencies generally below the optical range. So this is the terahertz range. We do broadband microwave measurements. And so we're exploiting and developing technology, which is used really to target this region, this very, very difficult, technically difficult frequency range in solids. And we're working on a variety of different things, exotic superconductors, disordered systems, amorphous superconductors, electronic glasses, and now topological insulators. OK, so I don't need to give any real introduction to this audience in particular. But let me just suffice to say that topological insulators, we believe to be a unique insulating state of matter, not adiabatically connected to the vacuum or normal insulators. And they're distinguished by topological properties that are wave functions, not broken symmetries. So this is a paradigm which we inherited from the quantum Hall effect. These have consequences that we have topologically protected surface states. In the case for bismuth selenide, an odd number of Dirac cones on the surface. It essentially ends up being something close to 1/4 of graphene, the equivalent of 1/4 of graphene on the surface. One has the phenomenon of so-called spin momentum locking. For every momentum position, there's a spin state which points in the orthogonal direction. These surface states should be robust to non-magnetic dirt. They should have high mobility, suppressed backscattering. They may exhibit novel quantum Hall effects in magnetic field, and also proposals for various novel electrodynamics. So there have been many, many good experiments, and you heard a summary of at least of a good a swath of the ARPES field from Zahid Hassan, I think, here 2 weeks ago. But I would say that the majority of good experiments on topological insulators have been with surface-sensitive probes. So that's angle-resolved photo emission, STM, experiments like this. So these experiments are typically used to look at materials where we want to look at bulk properties. But here we find that a lot of the interesting physics is at the surface, and so these experiments have really come to a fore, photo emission and tunneling measurements. In contrast, there's been many, many fewer experiments really doing what I would call high-quality transport experiments. And this comes for the very specific reason that the vast majority of materials that we've been able to find, which are topological insulators, have rather appreciable bulk conduction. So they may have surface states, but essentially the bulk of the material is not really an insulator. It's some kind of disordered metal or hopping transport insulator, which really has appreciable bulk conduction. And so what one finds when you actually try to do an experiment on them, you get really quite appreciable shunt conductance through the bulk of the material. And that's really prevented a lot of the beautiful physics which has been predicted in these compounds from being observed, at least in these 3D materials. There's a lot of work out there, and this is the two experiments are by no means representative of all, but just to give you a gross feeling for what's going on, this was essentially first generation try at looking at bismuth selenide, which is a second generation material. And you can see here for undoped bismuth selenide, the resistivity is essentially decreasing with temperature, much like a metal. If you dope it with calcium, the resistance comes up, but still kind of comes in and then comes in flat at low temperatures. Okay. This is not the surface state here. This is still the bulk shunt conductance. So it was estimated in this work, this is from Ong's group, that the surface to bulk conductances are still less than percent, the ratio. The situation has improved, and so this is more work, now also from Ong's group with samples grown by Kava. This is bismuth selenide tellurium. And this is a recent paper from earlier in the year. In this work, this is the best that I've seen in kind of large macroscopic size single crystals. And here they estimate surface to bulk ratio of about 1. So this is, as far as I know, the best that really anybody has done with normal sized crystals where one would one could be able to do kind of conventional transport style experiments on them. So this implies that if you could make, for instance, films, which are maybe not the problems with bulk conduction are not too bad, then thin films would be an ideal platform for transport investigations, because in principle you could shrink them down thin enough such that the bulk is a rather small fraction of the total conductance. You can see these crystals are still quite thick, 100 microns. Now people can do a better job by cleaning them, but this gives you a feeling for what most groups are doing. Okay, so let's talk about the experiments. So as I said, progress is really done by the people making materials. And in that regard, we're very fortunate, again, to work with Sean Oh's group at Rutgers. They're doing molecular beam epitaxy, layer-by-layer atomic deposition. Sean has found that by far the best material to grow these films on is sapphire. So this is the so-called 0001 sapphire surface. And they get much lower defect densities than, say, other substrates like silicon or something like that. And so that the bulk conductivities approach those of the single crystals. However, you can take it and make it as thin as you like, essentially, and thereby try to suppress the bulk signal. So you know, you get very, very nice flat surfaces with large surfaces between step edges. This is so-called layer by layer atomic deposition. Okay. And I should say that Sean's group has demonstrated that for films that are less than 200 quintuple layers, essentially 200 nanometers, that the surface transport dominates. Okay.
How did they demonstrate that? Do you remember? What did they do?
It's not a trivial issue. So, I should say that's why I said within this model. So, within a model for two carrier transport. So, they do manual resistance measurements. They model with one particular charge carrier in the surface and one particular charge carrier in the bulk. And then they fit that.
Is there strong cosine theta dependence in transport that they have a magnification or something like that?
Yeah, so I don't think that they've actually done that, but so I should say they've demonstrated within the context of doing Hall resistivity measurements, and they can fit and show that there are these two contributions, one of which scales with the thickness of the film, one which doesn't.
What kind of probes do they have integrated with the NBE machine? Do they have any?
They don't have things like PhotoMission installed. They don't have STM, as far as I know. The MBE machine itself has some very nice features in terms of making heterostructures. So unlike many groups, they can do, say, deposition of, say, niobium supernecking films on top. They can put all kinds of different capping layers on. But as far as I know, for interrogating the materials, they're a little limited, and then they have to take them out. They evaporate leads, and then they take them out to do whatever, give them to us, give them, do their own measurements on them. They're collaborating with a number of people. Yeah, but there's no in situ photo emission or in situ STM. Okay, so the material is this bismuth selenide, and it grows in general in five layer steps. So when I talk about this is about a nanometer here. So you can see it's alternating layers of bismuth and selenium. And when I talk about a quintuple layer, I'm talking about a block in this fashion. So generally these grow quintuple layer by quintuple layer. Okay, so I'm going to tell you a little bit about the data, and maybe unusual for this audience, I think that the kinds of experiments we're doing on terahertz conductivity are going to be very, very useful in this field in years to come. So maybe perhaps unusual for a theory audience, I'm going to tell you a little bit about the experiments. So going forward, you'll understand how myself and other groups perhaps are doing them. These terahertz measurements are being exploited by a number of groups to look at TI films. So this just to give you, I'll tell you about it, what this all this means and go into more detail in a moment, but this just gives you brief look at the data. So this is the real conductance versus frequency, and this is something like a Drude peak here, and this is a phonon, and let me come back to what all of this means in a moment. I just want to show you the data before I tell you about the experiment. It works in the following way. There's a femtosecond laser, which produces essentially pulses of laser radiation at about 80 megahertz. These pulses are very, very fast. So you can just think of them, for all practical purposes, as kind of a delta function pulse of radiation, which goes out. It hits a beam splitter, part of the radiation continues on, and part of it comes around. The radiation that goes forward hits a device, which we call an Austone switch, which is a piece of gallium arsenide, which has some electrodes grown on the surface. These electrodes have grown on gallium arsenide, and this gallium arsenide is insulating. These electrodes are biased by, say, 10 to 20 volts, but the material is so insulating that it has a resistance between them, even though this gap here is about 5 microns. The gap, the resistance between the two leads is in something on the order of about 50 megaohms. But then you come in and you zap it with the laser, and there's this shower of electron hole pairs which are created. The resistance of the switch drops, and it's biased. And so charge accelerates across this gap and kind of jiggles on the scale of a picosecond. This picosecond scale jiggling, this is what gives you the time structure of terahertz. So 1/1 picosecond is a terahertz. And so what happens is there's a pulse of electromagnetic radiation, essentially a single cycle. This is the electric field as a function of time, which goes off, propagates, say interacts with a sample, hits some mirrors, and then falls on a photoconductive receiver. The photoconductive receiver works in the following fashion. There's this transient electric field propagating through space, which then biases the structure. Okay? But the structure has this, again, 50 megaohms resistance. But part of the radiation came around, a laser, and was focused down to the switch. It's focused onto it, again, makes it active for a short period of time, and then the switch closed. When it's active, charge can flow across the switch and amount in a direction proportional to the size of the electric field. Then one changes the optical delay, and if you will, you measure the electric field at a particular time, then you measure the electric field at another time, and in so doing, you can map out the electric field as a function of time. Generally, we look at the Fourier transform of this. This technique does a number of things very well. Not only does it give you these frequency components, which are hard to get to by other techniques, but because it's a time domain technique, we also measure the phase directly. So really just, this is a transmission function here that we measure. We measure a complex transmission function. And essentially, from measuring the complex transmission function, we can just automatically invert to get the complex conductivity. Generally, complex conductivity is not something which is directly accessible in an optical experiment. You have to, say, measure the power transmitted and Cramer's quadratic transform it to get the phase. But we can just do it directly. So it's very, very useful, particularly if the natural frequency scales are down in this hundreds of gigahertz to few terahertz region. Okay, so again, just to give you a feeling for what happens, this pulse, say, interacts with some material, and some of that radiation is, say, reflected back, but some of it continues onward. If this is some dielectric sample, some of that radiation reflects off inside the material, and say, is reflected this way, but some of it's reflected back, and if you will, you get this radiation which is kind of rattling around inside the dielectric. This then appears, the time domain trace is these multiple echoes. Each time that it reflects, some of it gets transmitted, and you get these subsequent pulses. Okay. So that's seen here. quite dramatically, this is not a topological insulator. This is strontium titanate. It's a conventional insulator. But strontium titanate is a beautiful dielectric material which has these unusual properties that its dielectric constant at low temperature becomes huge, becomes about 40,000. This means its index of refraction is a few hundred. So that means the speed of light goes, this light goes very, very slowly in this material. So what you're seeing here as we cool down, this is the electric field as a function of time. These multiple peaks are these echoes of radiation rattling around inside the sample. This is essentially time in the horizontal direction. And so what you're seeing is it starts off at, say, at high temperature, and you see these multiple echoes. The dielectric constant is something which is normal, and then it becomes just this, it becomes this very, very large value. And it takes longer and longer amount of time for the light to get to the material, and it just kind of passes out of the measurement window. So most materials don't do this, but this is a nice demonstration of the technique involved. So we're generally interested in the Fourier transform. So this is the magnitude of the Fourier transform. And so this is the transmission function now as a function of frequency. And these little resonance here, these are what we call Fabry-Perot resonances. These are the frequency domain equivalent of those echoes you saw in the previous slide. And therefore, you basically get these transmission maxima whenever you can fit a half integral wavelength inside the sample. So we're going to generally, in our measurements, we're going to use only the first echo through the sample for the first set of measurements, but we're going to take advantage of these multiple echoes in the experiments later on for a particular reason that I'll get into. Okay, so let me show you the data. So this is bismuth selenide. It's 100 quintuple layers. Okay, so it's an average thickness. This is far thicker than you would have to worry, say, about, say, the two surface state layers talking to each other. So this is the conductance, the real conductance, as a function of frequency at a bunch of different temperatures. And so you can see a few different things. There's a peak down here at low frequencies. This looks something very close to some kind of Drude-like peak here. Then there's a peak which is situated at about 1.9 terahertz. This is known that there's a phonon in these materials, bismuth selenide, for some time. Of course, bismuth selenide is something that people were investigating in the 70s and 80s as a good thermoelectric material. So there's lots of data out there on it. This is, in the literature, is called the phonon, so-called alpha mode. And it has to do with the relative motion of bismuth and selenium atoms in a transverse fashion in the material. The primary interest, of course, is all of the low-frequency physics, which is down here. You can see that there's this kind of strong temperature dependence. But at low temperatures, we get this relatively sharp peak. This has a scattering rate, which is given by the half-width, which is about a terahertz wide. It's not something as narrow as you might see in some kind of high-mobility gallium arsenide 2D electron gas, but it's pretty good for a material, particularly one where the active layer, if you will, is just exposed to the environment. Okay, so we can fit this data. We can use various Drude-Lorentz models. This is the data I just showed you, and as I said, we actually measure the imaginary part at the same time. So when we fit data, we can measure, we can fit to the real and the imaginary part simultaneously, and you can see we can do a pretty good job with using a few oscillators to parameterize this data. Okay. So let's look at a few different thicknesses. The 100 QL sample is the one I just showed you. 16, 32, 64, 100, even 16 now, that's quite a bit thicker than you would have to worry about the two surfaces talking to each other. So as a spectroscopist doing optical conductivity, one of the things that I like to do is to look at not just the values of these quantities, but I like to look at the areas. So there are various conductivity sum rules that I can exploit in analyzing the data. So when I look at the low frequencies here, I see that essentially it's completely independent of thickness. Okay, the high frequency point, the high frequency stuff is the phonon, and that is not independent of thickness. This is just what I would expect, of course, for the phonon. The phonon has anything to do with the surface states. That's a bulk feature. When I look at the spectral weights, I can plot them, say, as a function of thickness. I find, sure enough, that the spectral weight in the low frequency Drude peak is independent of the thickness, whereas the spectral weight in the phonon just scales with thickness, as I would expect. So thereby, we can assign what we're actually seeing in these very, very thin films, right? 100 nanometers thick, 16 nanometers thick. We're seeing essentially pure surface transport. We've been able to make the material thin enough that the bulk is a really insignificant contribution to what the main transport is.
Does the room shift much in this thin slab? I mean, you don't have slab molds on those things, it's not that thin yet?
No, it's not that thin yet. That's it's something we thought about, yeah. but we don't see anything. We don't see anything like that. Yeah, we haven't looked at much thinner than 16 quintuple layers because we there may be some broadening which has happened.
No, there's definitely some broadening.
Yeah, there may be some. I see. Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, it may be that.
Those are round, so you see the funnel directly. You do see mm-hmm. that.
We haven't looked at it. We'll also look. There is some broadening here. We haven't looked at this in detail because, of course, our focus is down here. But we actually start to look at using the phonon, and what's that?
You may have something there.
We may have something there. And the other thing, we want to get a more accurate measure of what actually is surface conductivity and bulk conductivity. And so what we're going to start to use is we're trying to analyze this in terms of Fano line shape, where this phonon peak is interacting with a broad electronic continuum. But this is just some kind of thoughts and words at this point. We're still working on that. Okay, so the point is the takeaway message, if you will, is that for thin films this thin, essentially we're purely surface dominated. Okay,
there is an acoustic or optical phonon.
This is optical. This is an optical phonon. Yeah. So it's So it's again. It's the relative motion of bismuth and selenium atoms mm-hmm. against each other in the unit cell.
Inside the unit cell.
Yep. Yeah. Q equals zero. We're always measuring at Q equals zero. So in a sense, it's a nice, you know, the phonon is essentially relevant to a lot of the physics maybe we're interested in, but it's a good diagnostic that we essentially know what we're doing because we can see basically that it just scales with thickness because that's the size of the material. That's the thickness of the material. Okay, so we have pure surface transport. Let's go and look at the temperature dependence of this. So this is the temperature dependence of the Drude scattering rate, if you will, fitting that low temperature, low frequency peak. And I don't want to get into the details of this, but it has a very interesting, it's monotonic, but it has a very interesting temperature dependence with this rather notable cusp here. You can see this is plotted from 0 to 1 terahertz, essentially. The scattering is overwhelmingly dominated by elastic scattering. And the inelastic contribution here is probably phonons. And we believe that this cusp in here may be coming from some kind of effective Debye frequency, which is reduced down from, so the Debye temperature in bismuth selenide is about 180 Kelvin, and it's generally believed in semi-metals like this. You have such a small Fermi surface, this essentially renormalizes the Debye temperature down.
And it falls by the temperature, what's
1 terahertz in temperature? 1 terahertz in temperature is about 40 Kelvin.
It's very large.
Yeah,
it's a lot of
standing. Yeah, these are not. I mean,
they're not high mobility systems.
They're not. It depends what you want to compare to. As I said, if you want to compare to something with gallium arsenide, there's no comparison.
Gallium arsenide, that number is 10 to the minus 4.
Yeah, sure. Okay, so but you want to compare to any. If you want to compare to any 2D electron gas, it's no comparison. These are more disordered.
So
than
when people ask about the mean free path,
what's that?
Can you convert it to a mean free path?
I have done that.
I think it'll be 1 angstrom.
No. It's I think it's hundreds of nanometers or even almost a micron. It's reasonably long. I think hundreds of nanometers.
But what is the carrier density? I think about 14 parts per centimeter.
That's right. So but the remarkable thing is that this is not, of course, it's not a 2D electron gas buried below some interfaces protected from the world. This is a film which is exposed to the environment, right? It was taken out of the MBE machine, put in a plastic bag, which was pumped down and sent to us by FedEx, and then we put it in and measured it, right? So it's been exposed to all kinds of gases.
So they don't put the cap layer?
There's no capping layers on these. They're investigating.
Even during the shipment, they didn't.
No. Yeah, and that actually ends up being relevant for some of this. So we're looking into the details of that, but the story ends up being kind of complicated about the way you might want to do that. I'll come to that later on. Okay, so I don't want to talk about this in detail, but we think this might be some kind of reduced Debye temperature, which basically comes in from the small Fermi surface.
So on the surface. And the low temperature is like proportional to T. And then a little bit higher temperature is T squared, right?
Yeah.
Have you?
So it looks something. It's something like this. You know, I don't. fitting power laws with large offsets is a tricky business, and I don't want to get into it too much. But it's clear that I think you can take this temperature scale as something quite robust. It's about 10 Kelvin. So something interesting is happening at 10 Kelvin. And so what we want to do in the future with this is look at different dopings and basically see if this cusp moves as the size of the Fermi surface changes.
Sorry, Peter, what is the small Fermi surface you're referring to?
Well, just the surface of so there's a Fermi surface of bismuth selenide in the surface there, and it's some few percent of the Brillouin zone size. So the general thought is in semi-metals, then the effective Debye temperature goes down by some ratio, say, of the Fermi wave vector over the Brillouin zone size. But so that's what I mean is that there's essentially a factor of 10 or 20 that the Debye temperature is the effective Debye temperature should be reduced by.
Well, just to make sure, this case, thinking of Debye temperature in the standard way is not very useful. The important scattering is phonon scattering across the Fermi surface. Mm-hmm. So the relevant phonon energy scaling for 2D, this sort of 2D electron gas is phonon energy at wave vector 2kF.
Right.
And that's, that boils down to what you're saying.
Yeah.
But the correct energy scale corresponding to Debye temperature is the phonon energy corresponding to 2kF. So 2kF times phonon. And that's always a small number compared to
different. Right. So I think it's similar to, I was saying KF over the Brillouin zone size is probably the same thing. Yeah, with some factors of unity in there. And here, of course, we don't have pure backscattering, perhaps, but these are defects.
So at some point, you may try to put it back into something so that you can tune it.
Yeah, this is going to be tricky also for these particular experiments because we do the experiments in transmission. And so if you put some thick metallic gate on it, then you have a hard time transmitting through the whole structure. So what we're trying to do is we're actually developing ways of doing measurements in reflection. Mm. And then we're going to really be in business, and we can do all kinds of stuff. But we haven't done that yet. Yeah, but reflection is very tricky with this technique. OK, so what I didn't tell you when I was showing you this data is that the films that I was showing you at were about 5 or 6 days old. Okay, and by 5 or 6 days old, what I mean is they were given to us. We measured them, we took them out, we let them sit on the bench overnight, we measured them the next day. What we find, in fact, is that when we actually get a film right away, let's say here this is for a 64QL film, this is the red curve, conductance is actually up here. And its conductance falls over the course of a few days until it eventually ends up somewhere down here. Okay? So it's these curves, in fact, that I was showing you on the previous slides. If I was to make a similar plot of curves all at day one, in fact, they don't all fit on top of each other at the lowest frequencies. Okay? So the point is that what we believe is that in a quote-unquote fresh film, that there are two contributions to the conductance. We believe there's a surface contribution, and we also believe that there's a bulk contribution. Okay? And so we can go and we can fit this. And in fact, if we decompose the spectra into the various components, it's hard, of course, to fit it when these to fit the small component when the component is so small. But for a fresh sample, it's really quite obvious that the spectral shape is actually highly non-Lorentzian. And we think that this is due basically to the superposition of two Lorentzians in here. So this blue curve is from the surface feature, and the red curve is from the bulk feature. But then that goes away after a few days. And what we think is going on, so this is a plot of that data, of this fits as a function of time. And so this is, again, a plot of not the conductivity, but it's a plot of the spectral weight. So it's some integral of these features as a function of frequency. And so what we find is, as a function of time, spectral weight, well, of the surface, decreases a little bit, but not that much. But the bulk, essentially, after a few days, just disappears. And we just don't see anymore. There's rather large error bars on it out here. And in fact, this is just how the fit comes out, but the error bars are quite large. And in fact, we can't really resolve much of anything out here. So when I was showing you these samples and telling you that they were showing surface-independent transport, that was from samples which were about 5 days old or more.
So what about bulk DC measurements? Is it when you received it, it's more conductive, and as it ages, it becomes less conductive?
That's right. Yeah, but this is
not what everybody. Yes.
No, but I know that's not what they see. That's not what they say. But we're actually doing something quite a bit different here. So. Well, I'm not sure that anybody has done. The only people I know that have done measurements as a function of time on the scales of hours to days are our collaborators at Rutgers. So what people have observed is that they'll take a crystal, a bulk crystal, they find that they can cleave it, and then they got to put it in the vacuum basically immediately. So we're talking, I think, about very, very different things. There's clearly two kinds of aging effects, or we believe, I should say, that there's two kinds of aging effects. There's this aging effect which happens over the course of a few days, which we believe is oxygen diffusion in replacing selenium vacancy. And then there's some kind of doping effect which happens on the surface. And those happens when that's the kind of thing that they observe that happens in a photoemission chamber and over the course of hours. But a photoemission chamber, right, has 10 to the minus 14 atmospheric pressure as composed to, you know, normal environment. So that gives you some sense of the difference in time scales. So what you would see over the course of hours in a photoemission chamber, you would see, you know, over the course of femtoseconds in atmosphere. So, you know, we're sensitive, I think, just to different things. And what's going on here is what we believe is happening is that over a few days, oxygen is actually diffusing in. And oxygen likes to substitute for selenium. And it's kind of soaking up some of the selenium vacancies. And that's why the bulk conductance goes away. That's what we believe. So and water vapor may actually play a very large role in this also, where H2O comes in and then reacts to form hydrogen selenide. That's a gas, and that evaporates out as well. We're working out these issues now. Right now, we don't know.
Do you have any of these bulk modeling measurements to show as a function of temperature, like days or something? You say consistent bulk modeling measurements. This is what Schutzing was asking too. Do you have them somewhere? I mean, I realize it's done in Goldfields.
Yeah, I actually didn't have the plots with me. Yeah.
What are the mobilities?
Bulk mobilities are. So I think that. I don't believe that the bulk mobility is changing very much. There's the carry density, which is really changing. So that's the. So the bulk mobility is on the order of a few thousand, 6,000, 7,000. So it's not so bad. But again, it's not.
No, I understand, but that's pretty good.
Yeah. Okay. So let's look at what happens with magnetic field. Now, so we're going to take these thin films where we've identified that we have surface transport and put them in a magnetic field and go from there. So what do we expect a magnetic field to do? Well, you know, these topological insulators are billed as having very important aspect that they have time reversal symmetry. So you put a magnetic field on and we expect them to break time reversal symmetry. And it will, if you will, do a variety of different things. It gaps the surface states. If the mobilities or the scattering rates are small enough, the mobility is big enough, the scattering rates are small enough, we expect to see some kind of magnetoresistive effects and Hall effects of the surface states. We're doing finite frequency measurements. We may see cyclotron resonance. At higher mobilities, we may see some kind of Shabbat-Haas oscillations, which then eventually go into some kind of quantum Hall effect. And these are, if you will, some different ways of saying different, of somewhat the same thing in different limiting cases. OK, so what do we expect? Well, a quantum Hall effect in a single spin momentum locked 2D Dirac cone is expected to have this kind of behavior. So as usual, for a 2D electron gas, you will get an edge state. Okay, magnetic field goes in this way. The edge state forms on the side. And if it's a pure quantum Hall effect with no longitudinal conductance, then for an electric field in the y direction, we'll get a current in the x direction. Given by, famously, by these quantized amplitude e squared over h times, in this case, n plus 1. Now, n depends on a number of things, on filling factor, the field one's using, chemical potential. But it depends on the doping, essentially where the chemical potential would be in the Dirac states. But it's believed that the 1 half itself is essentially a property which derives from the bulk. Now, in order to see that, we would have to go to very, very high magnetic fields, essentially, so that we were only looking at the zeroth Landau level. Or we would have to have dopings, which essentially came in and put the chemical potential at the Dirac point itself. As I'll discuss, we're not anywhere close to those limits, but it's still interesting to see what we get. This kinds of functional form for the Hall conductivity has, as some people in this room are the theory that they're responsible for, has been shown that if you're in a regime where, so let's say if you have some magnetically gapped surface, and you're in a regime where the surface exhibits would exhibit a quantum Hall effect, meaning it has no longitudinal conductivity, purely a Hall conductivity, then if you imagine, say, taking some material of topological insulator as such, maybe you can construct it such that you have some magnetic material which points out radially everywhere along it, and this exhibits a field large enough to gap the surface states, and mobility is quite high, and you put an electric field in this direction, this will result in a circulating current. The circulating current will be indistinguishable from a bulk magnetization. And so, if you will, the magnetization in a y direction is proportional to the electric field in the y direction with some coefficient, which we can call alpha, which is given by e squared over h times n plus 1/2. And so in this sense, the surface current is indistinguishable or equivalent to a bulk magnetization, and this has been called a magnetoelectric polarizability. Okay. And so in this situation, which is admittedly not the situation that we're in with real materials, at least not at this time, one can describe this, it has been described, by a modification to the electromagnetic Lagrangian and mapped onto the problem of the so-called axion electrodynamics. I'm not going to talk about this in detail, but I will say some things at the end of the talk about what we might need to realize this regime in the real materials. Again, the important thing to keep in mind here is that the 1/2 is set by the bulk topological properties. Now, in a real material, if you had a quantum Hall effect, the situation is not naively this one, where we have a 2D electron gas. If we have a bulk material, we have essentially two 2D electron gases on top and bottom surfaces, but then there's side modes, if you will, also. So there's this non-gapped Dirac metal side surfaces. And so if I'm going to do a transport experiment, I would have to take those into account as well. Now, there's been a fair amount of theory discussing exactly how one might take into account these metallic surface states on the sides here, which don't get gapped, how you could take those into account in transport experiments. But an alternative point of view would be to do optical conductivity experiments, where essentially the light is focused to some interior portion of the sample, and the edges aren't even relevant to the situation. And so that's what we're interested in. OK, so we're going to be looking at the reflected light and the transmitted light. Reflected light, in general, the rotation of reflected light is called a Kerr effect, due to John Kerr. I couldn't find out the exact date, but it was around 1870. And transmitted light suffering a polarization shift is called the Faraday effect. And that's by Michael Faraday in 1845. So when we look at, we're going to put a magnetic field on it now. This is bismuth selenide. This is at 5 Kelvin as a function of the conductivity, as a function of frequency. This is the longitudinal conductivity at a bunch of different fields. Okay, so 0 is down here, the red curve. And you can see it's a restricted spectral range from what I showed you previously, but it has this upturn here. This upturn is the beginning of that big phonon. Okay. As we put on larger magnetic fields, you see that the DC value of the magnetoconductivity comes down, and spectral weight, if you will, is transferred out to higher frequencies, and we form a weak maximum out in here. This spectral weight suppression, we believe, is due to the formation of a weak cyclotron resonance feature at high frequencies. Now, the thing I'm really after, though, is these Kerr and Faraday experiments. And here we've been able to exploit a rather unique aspect of these time domain Terahertz measurements, which was surprising to me that nobody has previously exploited that before we got into this business. It's interesting. I should have put the reference down here. Around the same time that we came out with these experiments, the group from Geneva of Hancock et al., of Dirk van der Merel's group, actually used the same, what I consider to be quite clever way of getting a Faraday Kerr rotation, essentially exactly the same fashion as us. And before that, before these two papers came out within a few weeks of each other, it had never been done previously to this technique, which has been around for a few years. So the idea is the following. Electric field, this terahertz pulse comes in and, let's say, interacts with the top surface here of the bismuth selenide film. Our bismuth selenide films are grown on sapphire. We exploit the sapphire itself to use it as an optical resonator so that we can measure both the Faraday rotation and the Kerr rotation in a single experiment. We do it in the following way. So the light pulse comes in, interacts with the front surface, and is, if you will, reflected back. Some of that light enters, passes through the film, and enters the sapphire, okay, hits the back surface of the sapphire, and is transmitted through, we would detect a pulse coming through. But of course, due to the impedance mismatch with the vacuum, some of that is reflected back, suffers an internal reflection. Okay. Some of it goes back this direction, but it comes back again, and then passes through the film this way. Well, these are these multiple reflections that I showed you previously. The interesting thing to note about these is that each of these peaks has a different history of its interaction with the film. The first peak just went right through the film. The second peak has information about its transmission through the film, but then its reflection off the film. So if you will, the first peak encodes information about the Faraday effect, but the second peak has information also about the Kerr rotation in it. So this is kind of a cute thing, which, as I said, thus far hadn't been really ever done before. It means that you don't have to set up an experiment to do reflection. which, as I said, for details I'm not going to get into, I don't want to get into, is difficult to do in time domain terahertz. But we essentially can measure Fourier rotation and Kerr rotation, but in a single, essentially a single scan.
So what about using the topological film to do multiple reflections?
Yeah, one can do that, but you would have to grow a film. I mean, if you're going to grow it on top, so you, in principle,
that process is already there. You're just not analyzing it.
Well, you're analyzing it. Essentially, this transmission through the way it enters is through.
Because, for example, this back beam can go to the.
Yeah. So the way we analyze it is that this is analyzed in the so-called thin film limit, where one looks at the transmission into the material and out of the material, and then takes the limit where the thickness of this material is much thinner than the wavelength, and what it enters in the end. You look at basically the geometric series of all of these multiple reflections happening in here. But they happen so quickly and over such a small distance that you don't resolve in a single pulse. In principle, experiments can be done where you would look. I wouldn't start with a molecular beam epitaxy-grown film just because you would need something on the order of millimeters in order to do it. And here we're talking about hundreds of nanometers. But in principle, you could use a crystal, and you could do similar experiments and look at the multiple reflections inside the material. The problem with doing that is that with the current generation of crystals, they're just not conductive enough, so that you're not going to get half a millimeter size thick crystal, you're not going to be able to resolve multiple reflections inside. It's just going to be damped out too quickly. So if we could find material which we could grow as bulk single crystal, which was really a true bulk insulator, like sapphire is an insulator, then we could do that experiment. Now we can't. OK, so what we're going to do here then is we are taking our sapphire with the Ti on top. We're applying a magnetic field. We're doing it in a geometry where we have three polarizers. I'll call them P1, P2, and P3 is missing somehow, but that's P3. So without any rotation, the amplitude of the transmitted electric field would go like cosine squared of theta as a function of the P2 angle here. So I'll call theta is the angle of P2. If the electric field is rotated by some angle variable phi, say in the Ti itself, then the transmitted angle here will be, it's sine theta times cosine theta. This is for, we do them in two different geometries where P1 and P3 are parallel to each other, and P1 and P3 are perpendicular to each other. So this actually, for this geometry, should be cosine theta, sine theta. And here, if the Ti rotates the transmitted light, it'll go like sine theta, cosine theta minus var phi. Okay? And we're going to analyze the first reflection, or the first transmission peak, and particularly we'll find that the second transmission peak is where a lot of the interesting stuff happens. So let's first take a look at just bare sapphire. So this is looking at the first pulse and the second pulse being transmitted through sapphire in this geometry where we have P1 and P3 are actually parallel to each other, and P2, we're spinning that as a function of theta. And so this is a polar plot of the transmission as a function of frequency of the transmission through as we go changing the theta angle. And so you can see it does exactly what we expect here, a cosine squared theta. Now, that's just sapphire. When we look at it with sapphire with a Ti on top, we get the following thing. And we can fit it, we get a cosine theta. The expectation is a cosine theta minus, say, alpha. If alpha is the rotation angle, 65 degrees, you get this nice kind of butterfly design. And it shows a maximum at 32, and that maps out to actually rotation angle in the substrate of 65 degrees. This is looking at the second pulse, the 10 tesla for a 64 QL film, 65 degree rotation. Now, you may not be familiar with, but Kerr rotation is a technique which is used generally in the optical range or the infrared range to characterize magnetization of thin films, permalloys, which are, say, used in magnetic read-write memory. Typical Kerr rotations in those kinds of experiments are fractions of a degree. So that's kind of what the standard is for measuring magnetization. So 65 degrees in a thin film is, as far as I know, it's a world record by an order of magnitude. People have observed in graphene about 6 degree rotation. Here we observe 65 degrees. So this is a world record by a factor of 10, if you're interested in those kinds of things. We can do the experiment in a different geometry where P1 and P3 are perpendicular to each other, the first polarizer and the third polarizer at 90 degrees. And that changes the expectation here to A sine theta cosine theta minus alpha. But you can see in the same case here, again, we get 65 degrees as the rotation angle that comes out. We could do these experiments in a different fashion, where we actually take the second polarizer, P2, and we're actually going to spin it at high frequency. I'll talk a little bit about these measurements in a moment. But what we can get out of that is a measure of the Kerr rotation very quickly as a function of frequency and magnetic field. So we can form these plots of, if you will, iso-Kerr angle, which come as such in the frequency magnetic field plane. This was a different film, 32QL. You can see there's a little bit of non-universality here. So this has a peak which has a maximum Kerr angle of about 49 degrees in the sample. Okay. But that's also a huge number as far as this stuff goes. So where does this come from? What's the effect? Well, we believe what it is coming from, as I said in the first plot in magnetic field, from a cyclotron resonance effect in the surface states. Okay? It's not, we're not in a regime, mobilities are not high enough where we're going to be in a regime where we're seeing quantum Hall-like physics. But we can take the cyclotron resonance physics, we can model it for the longitudinal and transverse conductance, plug it into our formulas here for the Kerr angle, and in fact model the data quite well. Okay? The large angle here comes in, if you will, from a near cancellation in these factors in the denominator in the tangent of the Kerr angle. And then we can plot it quite well. There's a cyclotron frequency, the fitted cyclotron frequency versus magnetic field, and it falls on a straight line as one would expect. And the slope that comes out of this is quite close to what you would expect. From that, you can fit the Fermi velocity, which and that matches Engelsdorf photo emission experiments to within 20%.
So that's supposed to be a square root, right?
For cyclotron resonance?
Yeah.
Not
the
at high.
Spacing is the square root. Right?
Yeah, the spacing is square root for the Landau levels.
Yeah.
Landau level structure, right? But
so, what do you mean here?
So at high, you get an effective cyclotron mass at high biases in the Dirac cone, which comes I don't recall the expression right offhand, but essentially it comes out so that you get physics essentially at high chemical potential that's indistinguishable from the detailed functional form is indistinguishable from that from parabolic band. So if you want to see things like square root, you're going to have to be much closer to the.
But this is an advanced structure. Advanced structure is like a square component which shows up at high density. Is that what it is?
No. That's not what it is. It's,
so it's just that simple.
Yeah, there's the effective cyclotron mass of a Dirac fermion at high biases. Is proportional to let's see, the effective cyclotron mass, I think we believe, is proportional to the square root of kF. So it has the square root dependence, but what you can bring it into is an effective cyclotron mass.
Yeah.
In the end, the end result is that the cyclotron frequency is still proportional to field. So that's right. Okay. So you may ask if some other effect aside from these topological states can explain this on the surface. Photoemission experiments have reported some kind of surface band bending effects and other bands which appear. We don't believe that we're sensitive to these, or we don't believe that we're seeing them. Again, I think that we're in a different regime of surface doping and surface chemistry than is seen in angle-resolved photoemission experiments. So if we use the observed masses that's observed in ARPES and the observed densities there, we get very, very different dependence here where this cyclotron, the Kerr rotation peak is peaked more like 2 Tesla. And essentially using the observed masses and densities, we can't fit our data at all. So we believe that it's quite consistent with this cyclotron resonance coming from the Dirac fermion surface states. Okay, now one can ask, so what I can say is that we've seen this incredibly large Kerr rotation, right? It's an order of magnitude larger than has ever been observed in any other material, but it's this funny number, 65, yeah.
So what's the Fermi level of interface?
It's, we believe it's about 200 milliev above the Dirac point. So what we've seen here is, we've seen this huge Kerr rotation, which is, again, an order of magnitude larger than anybody has ever observed. But it's this funny value, 65 degrees, right? It's not anything universal. Well, this universal physics is certainly not being exhibited. So one can ask what's needed to be in the so-called axion regime and to see it in time domain Terahertz experiments. Well, essentially, to be in this axion regime, this is equivalent to saying that you have to be in a regime where you have a well-developed quantum Hall effect. So if we can, we take our expression for Kerr rotation. It, as far as I know, it hasn't been worked out in the literature exactly what you would see in a time domain Terahertz experiment if you were in this particular regime. There's been a lot of experimental paper, theoretical predictions, but I don't believe anybody has actually done these calculations. We've done the calculations here, and this is in fact what you get. So if you have no longitudinal conductance and you have an effective GXY at E squared over H, say one coming from the top, one half of that coming from the top and one half of it coming from the bottom, you will find that your Kerr rotation ends up being given by this, n alpha, n squared minus 1. N is here's the index refraction of the substrate. Alpha is the fine structure constant. Fourier rotation is given by alpha over 2 over n plus 1. And so you can see that the combination here of measuring alpha, of measuring the Kerr rotation and the Faraday rotation, as we can do in our experiment, we have two parameters here, and we have two ones to measure. We might like to know the index refraction at high accuracy. We can measure the fine structure constant, if you will. So what do we need for that? Well, we need even better samples. So I think we have the best samples that are made in the world right now. But we need to be closer to the Dirac point, and we need higher mobilities. Right? In order to resolve some kind of quantum Hall effect, essentially the scattering rate has to be much, much, much smaller than the cyclotron resonance frequencies. And we're not anywhere close to that right now. So we need 50 Tesla magnetic fields, which we're not going to get. So we have 10 Tesla magnetic field. That's the best we can do. So we need much better higher mobility samples. The other things we need to do, and so this might be achieved by closer to the Dirac point by capping the samples in some fashion, or by backgating it, as Sucheng asked earlier. The other thing that we want to do is develop more sensitive instrumentation. And so this is something that we've been working on now, is this technique where we take this polarizer in the middle here.
So what's the error bar on the Kerr angle?
So in the error bar in those experiments that I just showed you, our error bar was about a degree. Uh-huh. So we need better than a degree. And I think we're going to get that in a fashion that I'm going to tell you about right now. So
the optical range is 10 to the minus 8 or something.
What is
the arrow bar on the Kerr rotation?
Oh, but this is Aaron's thing. This is that's a very specialized.
That's only the summit. That's extremely specialized.
The what, sorry?
He's thinking of this.
Yeah. That's a very specialized thing, right? So we actually have some thoughts about how to make a zero loop Sagnac interferometer with terahertz, but nobody has done this yet. Nobody has done that yet. We're thinking about how one might do that. And in fact, you might do it in somewhat the fashion that I will tell you here in a moment. So what we're doing is, in this geometry where we have these different polarizers, in the middle polarizer we spin, okay? So we're taking this middle polarizer, we've developed the instrumentation now to do this, where we take this middle polarizer and we spin it at some incredibly high speed, 10,000 RPMs, okay? And then we use so-called lock-in detection. We feed the output signal into a lock-in amplifier, if that language is familiar to you, and we detect the output signal at 2 times the modulation frequency. And you can work out, I won't go through the details here, that the in-phase output of the lock-in is proportional to the electric field in the x direction, and the out-of-phase output of the lock-in is proportional to the electric field in the y direction. This is not a trivial thing to make. A polarizer holder which can spin at 10,000 RPMs. And this is a very quick video that shows us of our development of this. This is my lab. This is our polarizer holder. This was developed by our engineering group at Johns Hopkins, which is they're typically building telescopes and this kind of thing. This was beyond my and graduate students' technical capabilities. It's done with greaseless nitride coated bearings. Because you can't use normal bearings here, the grease will just spin out. We want to spin this thing up to about 10,000 revolutions per minute. This on here is a wire grid polarizer coated with mylar. The outer gravitational acceleration on this is about 1,000 times Earth's gravity. So rather hot, stringent engineering precision taking in making this. So this is the lock-in that we're using here. And turning it up some more. And my prediction is that the calculations we've done is that we should be able to get well better than 0.1 degree, and I'm hoping to go maybe two orders of magnitude even better than that. That's nowhere close to what can be done with this zero-loop Sagnac kind of stuff, but those are just different experiments altogether. Yeah. So if we could do this in broadband at sub-degree resolution, then that would be some capability which hasn't been realized yet. Yeah.
What makes it spin? Is it electromagnetic induction, or is it?
Oh no, there's a motor down here, and then there's a No. It's not quite. It's fancy, but it's not that fancy. There's a motor down here, and then there's a belt which goes around it.
Really straightforward. It's just not obvious.
No. The motor is in back, but it. The main engineering expertise, if you will, comes in the detailing of this bearing here, which is this large, it's 3 inches across and spinning at 10,000 RPMs. And so that, it's not a trivial thing. Okay, so I have a few more minutes. And so I'm going to tell you, kind of shift gears a little bit and tell you about some things that we're doing on topological insulator and niobium bilayers. So using some of the same technology, we're going to be looking at what happens when you make interface of these thin films with niobium. Again, these experiments are made possible by the capabilities that Sean Oh has developed at Rutgers, where he can do this, again, layer by layer molecular beam epitaxy. And in situ, without breaking vacuum, he can deposit niobium on top. These require different deposition techniques, and so that's not a trivial way. It's not a trivial system to be able to develop that as well. The essential point is the following. So that if I take a TI film, which on its surface has, say, a Dirac cone with these so-called spin momentum locked fermion pairs here, and put it in contact with some conventional superconductor like niobium, one might expect to induce some kind of proximity effect in the surface state. In the conventional understanding, this could not, even if the, if you will, the predominant interactions are S-wave-like, the pairing between these spin momentum locked fermions has to be of mixed parity. And that essentially arises from the fact that if you have that this is not a spin singlet state, and if you want to pair these, you're going to have some kind of superposition, you will, of triplet and singlet order parameters. Okay? So in general, one may expect that you have order parameter components which are proportional to some kind of Px plus Ipy. This is called nodeless P wave on the interface. And so we can ask, what are the properties of such states? Now we're looking at, so what we're going to look at is niobium on the surface of these TIs. Niobium is a very nice material to look at here. It's nice for one reason, because it's essentially at least it's not a strong coupling superconductor like lead. It has a reasonably high TC, and in the regime that we're going to be looking at its thicknesses, say somewhere in the order of 10 to 20 to 30 nanometers, it has a very strong dependence of TC on thickness. So if anything is going wrong with our film, we have a very sensitive diagnostic to see what its TC is, from its TC to see what the thickness is. So if some part of the film, if you will, the niobium reacts with selenium to form niobium selenide, which is a completely different superconductor altogether, we'll be able to notice that because we won't have as much niobium there, and TC will be appreciably changed. So this is some data. This is a comparison of niobium film on sapphire. And this is niobium film on grown on bismuth selenide. Bismuth selenide actually grown on sapphire, but so this has bismuth selenide in between. What you see is at the very rough level, something which looks just purely like normal dirty D-wave superconductivity. So the blue curve is room temperature up here, and then we're cooling down. And so you see that their gap develops at low frequencies. This is this famous suppression of the gap edge singularity. So in optical conductivity, you get so-called type 2 coherence factors, so that the singularity in the BCS density of states cancels exactly, so that at, say, zero temperature, this would come down and be completely suppressed at the gap edge. In the niobium film on bismuth selenide, you see almost the same thing, but there are going to be some small differences here which may be significant. I want to say at the outset, before I get into the details of this, and this is, data is all very, very new, and we're working out the details of it, and so in that regard, I reserve the right to take the whole thing back. But I think what we've seen is quite robust, but I should say that it's an unfinished and unpublished work. So we can look at the imaginary conductance as a function of temperature, again at a bunch of different frequencies. Imaginary conductivity in a superconductor is proportional to N over M. This is like the superfluid stiffness. N is the superfluid density, the number of superconducting particles, with a factor of 1 over omega. So essentially, if you look at constant omega, these curves coming up, these are constant proportionalities to the superfluid density. So this is the niobium film on sapphire, and this is the niobium film on bismuth selenide. You can see that in both cases, TC is hardly changed at all. But the difference between the two is that the superfluid density in the niobium film on sapphire case is greater, say, by a factor of 50% over niobium film on bismuth selenide. TC, remember the TC of niobium is a very, very sensitive to the thickness of niobium. So in both cases, 20 nanometers of niobium was put down. And in fact, it matches the literature value quite well that where TC starts here. We see that the superfluid density is suppressed by niobium SF on the topological insulator. And we may interpret this as a consequence of the spin momentum locking effect on the TI surface, or perhaps some kind of inverse proximity effect going on. So I'm a spectroscopist. And so there are many different ways of discussing these optical conductivity. But the way I like to think of it is that, from a spectroscopist point of view, that the delta function, which occurs in the superconducting, in the superconductor's optical conductivity, occurs essentially when you open up a gap, it occurs to a conservation of spectral weight. Right? You open up a gap in the spectral weight, we have a sum rule on the conductivity, and that spectral weight has to go somewhere. It goes to the delta function. Okay? So this delta function is developed, it occurs due to the conservation of spectral weight when the gap is developed. In usual BCS, there's a strict proportionality between the gap size to the superfluid density due to this exact cancellation of the singularity in the BCS density of states. This is the so-called type 2 coherence factor. So if we see that the gaps are essentially the same, and TC is essentially the same, but the superfluid density is suppressed, this means essentially that there has to be a difference in the coherence factors because the suppression on the gap edge is different. And that's, in fact, exactly what we observe. So niobium on the topological insulator, you can see, has a higher conductivity at the gap edge. Now, this is presumably what we're observing here is some superposition of the normal superconductivity in the niobium layer going along with whatever is happening on the interface. So we see less spectral weight in the delta function. And in this regard, I interpret this as means somehow different coherence factors are associated with the gap edge suppression of the density of states. As far as I know, and I looked in the literature, but as far as I know, that no calculation has been done to see exactly what the proportionality is in a nodeless P-wave superconductor to say what the coherence factors are for the nodeless P-wave superconductor, and moreover, what's the corresponding, say, within mean field theory between the size of the gap and TC. This calculation doesn't exist, as far as I know. Probably somebody can go upstairs and do it this evening if they wanted. I don't expect the calculation is presumably quite difficult, but as far as I know, it doesn't exist. But it seems quite reasonable to me that coherence factors would be very different in this case where phase is essentially continuously varying along the underlying Fermi surface or along the gap function as it goes around.
Correct, Peter.
Yeah.
Which part of that figure is showing the difference in the
current? This edge right here.
Okay.
Yeah. So the fact that the blue curve is higher. Mm-hmm. And so red is essentially what we might expect here. I'm looking at the gap edge here. So the red is what we expect. There's a difference here. So if I compare red and blue, this means that for the blue case, less spectral weight went into the delta function because it stayed above the gap.
So I don't have a lot of experience of looking at graphs like this. It looks like a pretty subtle difference to me. But are you saying that it's a big difference? Between those two graphs?
I agree that it looks subtle here. We're not seeing the full spectral weight because we don't see exactly what's going on all the way down at low frequencies. But the difference here is large.
Can you go back to that? I just want to follow up.
Yeah.
I mean, if you had a car material, not a TI, some other material, radium and some other random substance, and that did not look that different, it would be more convincing. Right?
I agree.
And also, it looks like a quantity different that a theory can just explain as a parameter.
Yeah, I agree completely. So you might think that maybe a good way of proceeding was to take bismuth selenide and dope it with some other material a little bit.
Or just niobium and silicon dioxide or some other material. I mean,
okay, but what we would like to do is, say, take bismuth selenide and dope it with some out of the TI state
for example,
by a few percent.
Right.
And so
that's
exactly what we're working on now.
Peter, yeah. But it also looks like a little bit of cherry picking, right? If I go to the higher frequency, then the curves actually switch, and I mean.
Well, this ends up being the edge of. This ends up being the edge of the experimental range here of a few terahertz. So these results here are robust, though. I mean, here what you're seeing essentially through the miracle, if you will, of Cramer's Kronig, you see in the imaginary conductivity, you see that what's happening with the delta function at zero frequency, which we can never measure. But if I say that there's a larger or smaller delta function at zero frequency, which I can't measure, then I have to look to see how that spectral wave is, say, not conserved at high frequencies, and I have some evidence for it here.
And so the strong shoulder that developed, let's say, a quarter of a terahertz, you think that that's like the delta function?
No, this is the edge. This is the edge of. I think these are quasi-particles going on here. And we also start to become the edge of the experimental range. It probably chops off of the, you know, down here somewhere. But no, this is. I mean, the delta function is a delta function. So this is quasi-particles which are coming in that are. It's essentially the optical conductivity analog of the Hubble-Schlichter peak, that there's an enhancement of the quasi-particle conductivity below the gap, again due to the coherence factors.
In these experiments, you didn't have any magnetic field, right? Applied.
No, there's no magnetic field.
So you wouldn't expect to have a pure T plus AP state there.
That's right.
It's some other state.
Yeah.
Where
and we're also doing transmission through the whole stack of niobium, and certainly the niobium is 20 nanometers thick.
But what I'm saying that this is some other state which has very non-trivial properties on the time reversal.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, certainly I don't know the calculation of conductivity for this,
okay.
Superconducting state.
Yeah, as far as I know, the calculation hasn't been done, but I don't expect that it. I expect that it could be done. I mean, it would be nice just to have it done for the for nodeless P wave, and then I expect it would be a higher level of complexity to do it for this mixed parity state. But I don't see any reason why it couldn't be done.
Nodeless P wave has been done. You have done it, right? Correct.
Oh, you worked out. You have a. A calculation for coherence factors?
Completely done. The 20-page paper, yeah. For the nodeless field.
Oh, then we should talk.
Yeah. But I think in this case.
This is not nodeless field, is what he's saying, and I agree with him.
Yeah.
It's something more complicated.
Yeah, but what does nodeless P wave look like?
Similar to S wave.
Similar to S wave, I see. Okay. Okay, so that's it. In conclusion, we found a variety of different things. I think we have good evidence for thickness-independent transport in topological insulators. I remind you of the sample aging effect, which in the case of wanting to see pure surface transport is a good thing. Colossal Kerr rotation and the so-called suppressed superfluid density in superconducting TI bilayers. And for the future, we want a few different things. We want even better samples, perhaps capping layers to protect the surface, but at the same time, we still have to worry about bulk conductivity, which apparently is being ameliorated through oxygen doping. We also want to have the chemical potential closer to the rack point. Perhaps modulation doping is a good way to do this, to further reduce bulk density, and that could be some ideal application of the MBE technique. New instrumentation, higher resolution polarization terahertz measurements. This presents some kind of significant technological challenge, as I discussed with you. And what we're looking at now in detail is topological insulator, band insulator transition to doping, and possibly these vial fermion states. So, okay, thank you for your attention.